Tour is a production of iHeartRadio and Black Barrel Media. I'm your host, Brian Ray. On this show, we'll take you behind the scenes of the music business to give you the most raw and real tales you've likely never heard before. We'll share our wildest, most unbelievable, and yes, most embarrassing moments while on tour. In this episode, I caught up with my good friend, Steve Lukather. Steve does it all. Singer, songwriter, guitarist, producer, composer. He has one of the longest running gigs in the industry, and he's won more awards than we have time to list, including 5 Grammys. As a founding member of the band Toto, and now lead singer, he's never missed a show in 40 years. In addition to the mega hits Toto has given us, Steve has also been a part of more hit songs than you probably realize, among them Michael Jackson's Thriller and Beat It. He's contributed to albums by Van Halen and Joe Cocker. He's toured with Jeff Beck, Peter Frampton, and is currently a big part of Ringo Starr's All-Star Band. We could spend hours sharing his stories, so we did our best to hit the highlights with Toto, his touching stories with Paul and Linda McCartney, and his friendship with Ringo Starr, while not forgetting that time he snubbed the King of Pop. Here's my conversation with Steve Lukather. Hey, Steve, good to see you, brother.
Hey, Brian. Ooh. It's only been, what, 44 years or whatever, 43 years as we met?
Yeah, we've been knowing each other a while.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah, I guess so. We met in about 1980, right?
Oh, 78, man, when the girls put my first wife, Marie, and her twin sister, Cherie, did a record, and you were playing. And I just was dragged along because, like, I'm the boyfriend of one of them. I said, sure, I'll come along and play. But you had you and Joey Brassler, who's a great guitar player. So I just fumbled along and doubled everybody's parts. I mean, come on, this wasn't Mahavishnu music, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it wasn't exactly Mahavishnu music. It wasn't prog rock. But all I remember from it, because I was pretty loaded during that time, but what I do remember is seeing your smiling face and Joey Brassler and having a blast.
Yeah, well, Joey and I went to high school together.
Is that right?
People don't realize that, you know.
I didn't know
that whole thing at Grant High School. With Mike Landau, myself, the Picaro brothers, John Pierce.
Beard, was it?
Baird? No, Baird was older. Baird, you know, I didn't meet Mike until like I started doing sessions. Like, you know, the first time I worked with him was in 78. Right. I started actually doing sessions in 77 for real, like, you know, which is hard to believe at the time.
That's amazing, yeah. So I remember getting a call. I was looking for something to do. I had just come back from a tour with Etta James opening for the Stones. So I was like,
and now for something completely different.
Yeah, and looking for something to do because you know what it's like.
How did you get that gig?
With Etta James?
No, with Cherie.
With Cherie and Marie Curie, with you.
Well, I was just, you know, boyfriend at the time. I wasn't really in the band, you know.
Yeah, but that's not how I heard it.
Anyway, really? How did you hear it?
Steve Lukather's on guitar, and this was Joey Brassler calling me. Your old schoolmate.
Well, I sat in. They didn't pay me nothing.
Is that right?
Yeah. I just showed up so I could be with my girlfriend. I figured I might as well do something.
And you guys were just newly dated.
Yeah. Right? I mean she was 18. I was 20. Or she was 19. I was 21. One of the two, you know.
Damn. Look at that. I guess I was 23. We're about the same age. But anyway, yeah, I was just looking for something to do. And Joey called me and said, you know, we're going to do a string of dates around California and some Western states. Scott Carlson was the tour manager. Well, man, I couldn't have been happy to be there. We had a blast.
Well, we had a great time because I love the way you play. And I just thought, well, what am I doing here? You don't need me. So I just let you guys pretty much handle it. And I just junked the rhythm shit.
Do you have any memories from our touring days? Is it a blur like it is for me?
No, I was never as bad as the papers say.
You know. Oh, man, we've been two lucky blokes, man.
Yeah,
I've
had a pretty good run, man, in between doing all the sessions. And then I get to play with, you know, I love Ringo and we're hanging with him. He's become a dear friend of mine. And the hang is great. And it's my vacation gig. You know, we go out and have fun and that's what it is.
You know? I can dig that, man. So I remember reading that you started playing because of your love for the Beatles and George Harrison. Is that right?
Well, the whole thing, you know, I watched in 1964 like everybody else, you know what I mean? Like, and it was like life went from black and white to color, like The Wizard of Oz, ironically. And I just became obsessed. And the sound of the guitar, I remember hearing the solo and I saw her standing there mesmerized by it. I played it over and over and over again until my father said, if you play that again, I'm going to kill you. So I used to get real soft and put it, and then I started just fumbling around on it, and then one day it just made sense to me, and I started playing all the first position guitar chords, yeah. And no one ever taught them to me.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So were you always self-taught? Did you ever go to school?
No, you know, I started studying later. When I was about 14, when I realized that, you know, I had a pretty good ear. I could figure stuff out. But then when I met the Picaro brothers, when me and Landau and John Pierce went to Grant High School, we met Steve Picaro and his whole family. And all of a sudden, everything was like, whoa, what's this? Session musicians, and what are we going to learn? Oh, fuck, I got to learn how to read music.
Yeah.
Which is really difficult to do after you've been playing for 7 years. And you start to have to sight read Mary Had a Little Lamb or something like that. And then my teacher, Jimmy Weibel, very patient, God bless his soul.
Yeah.
But I had to learn a lot fast.
Yeah.
And then we were the first class of the Dick Grove School back in North Hollywood.
Oh, yeah,
Landau,
sure.
John Pierce, the Picaros. I mean, it was the first class. Almost everybody in the class has made a good career of being a musician.
Yeah.
So that was pretty cool.
That's really something, yeah.
But, you know, man, it was just like, once I got into the studying thing, I started studying orchestration, composition with Dr. Albert Harris. I had Jimmy Weibel, went to Dick Grove. I took every music class in high school, which, by the way, we really need music in schools, man.
Yeah, damn right we do.
I mean,
yeah.
I was never in the orchestra or the band or anything like that, but being around the music, studying harmony theory, first level piano, you know, all the sight singing, stuff you think you'd never use, I actually really did use it on, you know, when I started doing sessions and,
yeah,
you know, I really had to get it together. It was just very fortunate and grateful and lucky that I got the shot that I did. You know,
yeah, it is unfortunate. It's been cut from a lot of school budgets. But, you know, maybe one day we'll get to return to that, because it's not just the music and exercising that part of your brain,
right.
But it's the camaraderie. And,
yes.
And it's like a sport without the grass stains. I mean,
you know, reading music is just like learning a foreign language. It's not necessary, but it sure as hell helps if you're in the country that they speak that foreign language.
Exactly. That's really well said. So thinking about your career in the earliest days, and you're talking about Picaro and Landau, Joey, and Bay Pierce, right? That used to be his nickname, right?
Yeah. Well, that's a long story. No, John was my very first friend in the entire world. Our parents were pregnant on the same block.
You're kidding me.
No.
So your parents knew each other before you guys came to be.
Yeah, we high-fived each other on the way in. he was actually a couple of months older than me.
I was just thinking, you know, you went to high school with these guys who became first call session guys.
You know, Landau and I have known each other since we were 12.
Is that right?
Yeah. So, I mean, he was my second friend that went off to, you know, Mike and I are still very close friends.
Yeah.
One of the baddest motherfuckers in the world, man. He's
too
much.
Oh, yes. Bad,
you know, we're still tight. And Jeff Picaro and David Paich were already first call guys.
Okay.
Jeff was making KD Lide with Steely Dan when we were in high school.
Uh-huh.
And we actually learned a bunch of the stuff and would jam on it and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And so from that, we knew, wow, session guys, and we started, back in those days, remember, we used to do demo sessions.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like the minor leagues for session guys, where they'd pay you $25 a tune or something like to go in there before machines could make demos. I never got hired because of my ridiculous sight reading parts. They used to just leave shit blank, because I would try to, you know, I knew that I had to come up with something better than was on the paper.
That was,
I mean, I could read
job.
It, and I go, I start playing, and I go, I think I got something better.
Yeah.
And they let me go with it. And then after I developed some sort of a reputation, they just didn't write much for me at all and said, play what you want to play.
Yeah.
Unless it was very specific, and then you had to do it.
So your earliest days with these guys, were you called Toto when you first started playing? What was the band name at the time?
Still Life.
Still Life.
Which was a much better name.
Uh-huh.
We should have kept that name.
Who came
up with
that?
I did argue with the cats early, but I was 19 years old, and I didn't have the seniority at the time.
Yeah.
I'm like, guys, Toto. Are you kidding me? And the funniest story about that is, like, we were in the middle of the first album and we had been signed as Toto. And I was like, I can't fight this. I mean, it's not
Surrender.
Such a bad now.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is what it is now. It's been very good to me, knock on wood. But, you know, we didn't know at the time. And then we get a Polaroid in the mail from Tom Scott, who was in Japan at the time. And we didn't know there was a Toto toilet. So he sent us a Polaroid of his shit floating in the toilet. It said Toto on the toilet. He goes, nice name.
Oh, no.
But I'm holding it up going. And then, you know, I honest to God think that name did not help us at all. It was too easy to make fun of a band named Toto. You know, I was going, guys, we don't make humor music. What the fuck, you know?
Yeah.
But it is now 43 years, 44 years later, if you want to count high school since 73. So,
well, how did you guys come up with the name?
I didn't. Jeff McCarr and David Page did. They went out and, you know, had a pitcher of margaritas and some weed and went back to Jeff's house and watched The Wizard of Oz. And they kept on saying, we need a name like Toto. Simple, to the point. I'm going, and then they come and tell us, I'm like, we're in the middle of doing our first record. We didn't have a name yet.
Yeah.
I'm going, Toto, man. Some of the guys, yeah, that's a great, you know, I'm going, Toto, yeah, but The Wizard of Oz. No, it's not like that. It means that I'm going, yeah, but nobody's going to think they're going to go The Little Dog and The Wizard of Oz. And sure enough, the clincher was when we were looking for album covers, and Jeff was always our artist guy because he wanted to be an artist more than he did a drummer, if you can believe that. But, you know, the art department from Sony brought down potential album covers. And one of the first ones, they had brought an easel, like old school, like they were going to have the unveiling of their genius new idea. Mm-hmm. And we're all going, can't wait to see this. And Jeff being an artist, he's going, this better be good. Well, this kind of like surfer dude showed up and he was like, you guys ready to see it? And he opens up the easel and it's a dog bowl with curly cords coming out of it. And on the dog bowl, it said Toto.
Oh, no.
And it was so bad. There was dead silence in the room. And I think Jeff stood up and asked him to leave in maybe not such a nice way. And we sat back in the room going, fuck. And then Jeff found this guy, Phil Garris, who did the Fiddler cover for the Grateful Dead. And he started living at Jeff's house. And that's how that all came to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, it ended up being a great logo anyway.
Well, you know what, man? You know, what's in a name?
Yeah, what's in a name?
I mean, we tried names like the Butthole Surfers and stuff. And they were going, you can't do that.
Yeah.
You know, you can't. And now it's like, what do you mean? You can call it whatever the fuck you want to call it.
That's right, exactly.
But you know what? After 44 years, it's been good to me. Some people like the band, some people hate the band. I think we're misunderstood. If you've only heard the hits, that's not really conducive of all what we do. But you know what? It's kept me and my family alive for a long time. And
I'm very
grateful for that. You know, what is hip? Tell me. You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
And I'm the only motherfucker who's been there for 43 years.
Mm-hmm.
Steve was in the band for over 25 years.
You're the only founding member that's played every Toto show.
Yeah,
and every
Toto record. And I didn't want to become the face of the band, but everybody left me there. When Jeff died, everything changed. Because it originally, of course, it was really Jeff and Dave's band. You know, they were the ones that came off the success of Silk Degrees by Boz Scaggs, which made him a superstar.
Right.
And then I was still in school. And then I was asked to join the band right after high school and do the tour for Silk Degrees. And that opened up. I mean, Jeff Beccaro and David Page. And I had met David Foster, Jay Graydon, Lee Ritenour, and, you know, Carlton, and all these heroes of mine. And Jeff pulled me in the back door. You know, we'd call him and go like, be at Studio 55 for Diana Ross in 10 minutes. Hurry up, man. You better play good, you know. But. Yeah. And that's how I got in the door, you know, because I started playing with those guys. They gave me the thumbs up. You know, I've gotten to play with most of my heroes, you know, and one of them I'm in a band with now has become a very dear friend, Ringo, just like you are with Paul, you know.
Yeah.
Who would have thought that when we were kids that this would be our gig, you know?
Yeah.
And we'd be friends with all these wonderful musicians and heroes and stuff.
Yeah, that you and I would end up playing with two of the Beatles.
I got to play with George, and in your case, Paul, with George as well.
Wow.
I met Paul when we were doing Thriller.
Right. Tell me about that.
That was interesting. We were very, very excited about that. I was starting to work with Quincy a lot. Mm-hmm. I think I was about 22, 23 years old. I was doing the Dude record.
Mm-hmm. Right. Sure, Quincy.
And he was digging me at the time. And so he says, I want you to be on the next Michael record. And I'm like, wow, this is cool because Off the Wall had just happened.
Which was
huge. We knew this was going to be a big record, you know. And so I got called in to do all of that stuff with Q, you know. And then he said, we're going to do a duet with Paul McCartney. And I want you and Jeff and Paige and I think Louis Johnson played. And Foster might have been on that gig. And so we showed up And it was all this anticipation, like the two biggest stars in the world. I mean, Paul, obviously being Paul on a level all his own. And Michael was the hottest star of the time. And so we showed up early, and it was a big scene. There was, you know, understand, this was only a couple of years after we sadly lost John.
That's
right. So there was a big vibe about security and being, everybody was vetted and all this other stuff in ways that I wasn't even aware of, but whatever. So I showed up a little bit early because I want to make sure my shit was right.
You know, right, yeah,
it was an
right.
exciting day for me.
Sure.
To work with the reason, with one of the guys that's the reason why I play music.
Yeah.
This is a big deal.
Yeah, sure.
So we all wanted to be great and wanted, especially wanted Paul to dig us. We'd already passed the test with Quincy and shit like that. So we knew him. But Paul walked into the room with Linda, and it was a palpable difference in the air quality of the room. It was neat. And Jeff was smoking a joint. Paul and Linda walked in. I smell musicians. You know, and this is 1982.
Like the first thing he said?
Something like that. You know, we were all like, you know, trying not to blow. I mean, you know, I don't get starstruck that often. When, you know, when you meet one of the Beatles and you never have before, it's kind of a...
Yeah.
It's kind of insane. It's intense. And he couldn't have been the nicest man in the world, as you well know.
Yeah.
And Linda was a groove. She was great. And, you know, we did good on the session, and he really dug it. I came up with some two-part thing. He goes, and he says, how are you playing? I go, it's just a two-part thing. So I was like, wow, boy, he likes my part. Wow.
Yeah.
And so we did. I mean, I was set up in the soundstage for 2 weeks with Paul and Linda. I was on the same stand with Linda. And when we got there, we were told, whatever you do, don't talk about the Beatles. Don't play any Beatles songs. And we're like, what? We're here with George Martin, Jeff Emerick, Paul McCartney, and set up live, and we can't talk about the Beatles.
Or rip into a song of the Beatles.
Right.
You're like, this is strange.
I go, this is terrible. So I ended up, you know, I didn't say anything because you just don't.
Yeah.
We were 2 weeks there to do one song, you know, and we had already gone in and cut it the first day with George Martin. And, you know, the band, we nailed the part just in case. And, you know, so anyway, but it was wonderful to be set up. And I said this to Linda. I said, yeah, after we became a little bit more friendly, and she was just great to me. I said, yeah, man, you know, I don't know what to do. I said, we're not allowed to, like, ask Paul about the Beatles or play anything. I go, I feel, you know, he's like one of my all-time. I mean, this is a really terrible thing to do. And I was like, you know, you're in the room with your all-time hero, and you can't even talk about it. And she goes, who the hell told you that? I go, well, the management, whoever said that we're not. She goes, that's bollocks. And I go, really? She goes, yeah, play something. So I played Please Please Me. I started going to that, and Jeff looked at me like, are you out of your fucking mind?
Yeah, you got to get us fired.
And then I started playing, and then he started saying it, and then Jeff started playing it, and then we all started playing it, and the room stopped, you know? And at the end of it, the whole place went berserk, and then Paul goes, oh, yes, and then he starts telling us stories, and the floodgates were open, and we had lunch every day, and as I was able to pick the brain of George Martin, Jeff Emerick, and Paul, and we just had a blast.
Amazing. I'm glad that you were able to tell Linda that that was what you were told.
And yeah, another thing about it, I mean, you know, she got such a bad rep for reasons I will never understand. This is one of the coolest people I've ever met.
Yeah, I've heard.
And she's going to me, she goes, look, everybody hates me because I'm in Paul's band. She goes, he wants me in the band.
Yeah.
And I'm going, and I'm not talking for Paul. I couldn't do that. But she said that to me, and I laughed, and I went, really? I go, you know, girl, you're the coolest person ever. I go, I don't understand why anybody could say anything about you. You go, well, they don't know me, you know.
Yeah, I've heard she's just amazing.
Oh, she was a dog.
Warm to everybody. She would come up to people in the crew, the lighting guy, the rigger, and talk to them about whatever was going on in their lives.
You know what she did to me? Man, she, like, the kids were all young then.
Yeah.
And there was no, she was hands on. There was no, like, you know, nannies and stuff. John was the only guy hanging out.
Right.
And he's cool. And, but she goes, Larry, look after the kids for a little bit. You know, while I go off and do this meeting with Paul, I'm like, you're leaving me with your children. I go, me? I'm like the youngest cat here right now. And she goes, you can handle it. And I go, it was only like for like 15 minutes or anything. It wasn't like any big deal, but I was so nervous.
Yeah.
You know, and the kids were great. So it wasn't like I had to do anything. I was just going, hey, you guys got to be cool. I'm supposed to look after you. You know?
Oh,
not one of them would remember any of this, but I remember because it was like, if I blow this, I'm really in Schitt's Creek, you know? But it was very cool. It was great. She just tried, and then she sent like, you know, autographed like, you know, photo books and would explain things. She was just went over the top nice, man.
I've heard that about her.
Paul was the best. He was the greatest. I'm not telling you anything you don't know.
Yeah, right.
And we had a blast. And then I didn't see him again until we did that, you know, the 50th anniversary.
That's right.
Which I'm sure was as much of a trip for you as it was for me.
Oh, yeah.
What killed me was like waiting backstage to go on to play the gig and then showing Hard Day's Night. And I remember bugging my grandmother like 1,000 times to take me to see this movie.
Yeah.
I think, you know, nobody else wanted to see it anymore, but I had to see this thing as many times as possible.
Yeah, yeah.
She went out and bought me my Beetle boots, even though my parents thought my feet would grow into a hoof or something like that. You know what I mean? You know, and I'm like, fuck this. My grandma was the coolest, you know? So all these memories hit me.
Yeah. Did you have a Beetle wig?
No.
We did.
Well, I didn't have a Beetle
wig. I had a new stepfather in the family, and he was, you know, sort of courting the kids, the four of us. The Beatles had just come out. And he brought us all Beetle wigs, which I really appreciated. But like you, I was in the middle of the living room, cross-legged, waiting for the Beatles to come on because we'd heard like one single on the radio. And
yeah.
What the hell is this?
It was like the parting of the seas, man.
It was, yeah.
It was like aliens landed and gave us the secrets. You know what I mean? Yeah. And this music still holds up to me.
Yeah, and the records do too.
They never tire from me. And you know, it's fun. You know it is. You know, Ringo goes, it's 8 years of my life. When you think of what they did in 8 years.
Yeah.
From Love Me Do to Abbey Road, the growth.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's still the gold standard. Whenever you were in the studio making a record and we need kind of a Beatle-y thing. Everybody knows what that is.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I say to Ringo, who really pisses me off when people give him shit about his drumming.
Yeah.
I go, okay, first off, how many drummers do you know if you just play the drum track, you know what song it is?
That's right, exactly.
There was no click tracks on those gigs.
Yeah.
And they had to play. Now, is he Billy Cobham? No.
But you're not looking for Billy Cobham.
You don't want him to be.
You don't want him to be. Yeah.
And you know.
Remarkable.
He's one of the most amazing people I've ever known. And we've been pals for like almost 8 years now.
Amazing.
And, I told him he had to kill me to get rid of me.
He loves you, man. I can see when you guys are hanging out. We've been around each other a lot over the years. Ringo with you, yeah. Me with Paul.
Right.
And I think starting with that 50th anniversary of Ed Sullivan and just watching him he gravitates to you all the time.
Right. Well, you know, we just hit it off. You know, if his name was Bob Smith, he'd be my pal. I go, this is the coolest cat I've ever met.
Yeah, he is a cool cat.
But, you know, I'm very grateful and fortunate that, you know, he took a shine to me and we're buds. We hang out all the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just adore him as a human being.
What was your first meeting with Ringo like? Were you nervous and anxious about it?
I really wanted the gig because I knew I could make, first off, I knew I could make the band. I was going to give everything I had.
Right.
To make this a great band. I wanted to make, you know, and I got the call from Mark Rivera and I said, look, man, I really want to get in here and kick ass in this thing, man. I want to do a great job for the band and make sure everybody's working as hard on everybody else's songs as their own.
Yeah.
Because apparently I'd heard stories that guys in the band would only give a shit about their songs. And they'd scuffle through everybody else's tunes.
Yeah, that ain't right.
I thought, that's not a band. A band wouldn't do that. That's part of the gig.
Yeah, it's an all-star band. It's a review.
You and I, with our experience in the studios and all this stuff, I mean, I was doing this shit every day. You showed up and you gave everything you had to whatever piece of music was laid on to you.
Exactly.
And if I thought these are important parts, I'd learn the parts off the record and go, can I play it like this? Is this right?
Those are the hooks. That's what the people want to hear when they hear these songs.
You know, I'm sitting playing Santana songs with Greg Raleigh. And it's like, you know, and he's killing it. It's like, he hasn't lost a lick, man.
He sounds great.
His voice, his playing. I mean, he's
all of it.
Incredibly consistent. One of the nicest cats on planet Earth.
Yeah, it was great seeing you there at the Greek Theater and hanging out with you before the show. But I was really struck with that band cared about every single song that was being played.
Well, and I get to play bass Hamish is back, Hamish Stewart.
Yeah.
So I get to play bass on some of the, you know,
and how great is that?
And I loved it because I love to play bass.
Yeah.
Like not guitar bass, but bass.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Look at what you did. All of a sudden you get the gig and like, you got to be a bass player too. And you've got to be a bass player with Paul McCartney looking at you. It's like,
that's right.
That's a little like, okay.
Well, basically I didn't look up for the first 6 months. I mean, it's like I looked out of the side of my eye and there's Paul McCartney with the footlights on. It looks like Shea Stadium. And I'm going like, oh shit, I got to really fucking do this right.
But this is so great how you got the gig though.
Yeah.
You know, your buddy Rusty, right? Said, come on down.
It actually was Abe.
It was Abe. It,
you know, Rusty and Abe were both friends of mine.
Right.
But they didn't know each other yet.
Really?
But I played with each of them. Like, I'd been touring with Abe in France with Mylène Farmer and with Johnny Halliday.
Okay.
Johnny Halliday as well.
Right.
And with Rusty, he was a neighbor of mine. He was just like a guitar bud. And
yeah.
We'd trade gear and
sure.
play on each other's demos
yeah.
and do that stuff that we do as guitar
players.
He's great.
Players. I love him. What a sweet kid. Great player.
Great guy.
Yeah.
But the call came because Abe had gotten the call to do that album, and
right.
he was at a dinner that I was having, and I said, well, so Abe, like, who's going to play bass when Paul plays guitar and piano, and who's going to play guitar when he plays bass? Who's going to do that? And he goes, well, actually, yeah, we're looking for a guitar player who plays a bit of bass. And I put my hand up, and I said, man, I'd love a shot at that.
Well,
and that's how I got
guy.
The call.
I love the way you play bass in the band, because you play bass. See, a lot of guys like us, like if give a guitar player a bass and he starts playing, you're not
lead
playing bass.
Bass
anymore.
Yeah, that's right.
Like you have to hold those whole notes. That one has to be full value on the quarter note.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? It's a different vibe. You got a different mindset. I love playing bass. I play bass on my own records and shit.
Yeah.
Or, I play bass on Total Records. Don't tell anybody. But,
yeah. Yeah. Did you play some bass on some early sessions as well? Did you
play bass on
Michael?
I beat it.
On Beat It. That's
well,
what
that's
I was going to say.
Only because of the way the record went down. I mean, I wasn't like, you know, I played bass on a few things. I mean, I played bass on my song, the song I wrote with Foster for and Fee for Talk to You Later from the Tubes.
Uh-huh.
Because the bass player refused to play on it because he didn't write it.
Yeah,
I read that. Guys, what are you mad at me for? I didn't try to steal your gig.
Yeah.
Have you ever done sessions where the guy in the band that you're replacing is in the room?
Yes, I have.
That sucks.
With Shakira. It sucked, and I'm not going to name names, but man, it was really, really awkward. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I'm in there to replace the guitar parts that he'd already played. Yeah.
He's
a co-writer. Yeah, it was a little bit brutal, but anyway, it was.
Yeah, I've had that wonderful experience. I'm going, why don't you play this? Like, come on, what am I doing? And I'm going to the producer, what the fuck would you invite this guy here?
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? It's like, oh, it's man.
But you just mentioned Michael Jackson. So your first meeting with him, did I understand that you got a phone call?
Oh, yeah,
him?
No, at 8 o'clock in the morning, like 1981, and you know it was up in 1981. I get this call at 8 in the morning. Hi, this is Michael. I'm going, fuck you. I hung up the phone. A few minutes later, the same phone call. No, really, it's me. I'm going, okay, man. What moron calls musicians at 8 o'clock in the morning in 1980? Where are we? I just went to sleep, man. The fuck is this? It's Mike. I'm going, fuck off. Which one of my knuckleheaded friends is? Boom. Nobody calls. About 10 o'clock that morning, I get a call from Quincy's office, from Joanne, who would normally call.
Yeah.
Then I get a call from, that was really Michael. You should call him back. And I went, oh, fuck.
Oh, no.
So I call him back, and I said, hey, and he answers. I get the bat phone, and he answers, and I go, Michael, it's Steve Lukather. And he starts laughing. I go, man, I'm so sorry. I thought it was a gag. He goes, oh, it happens all the time.
Yeah, I had the same experience with Paul. We had just done our first, what I guess was my audition, which was one song for the Super Bowl in 2002, like before the national anthem.
Oh, great. Your first show is the
that's
9 billion people will see. No pressure at all. Nothing.
Right. And at the end of that gig, which is New Orleans, just one song, he gives me a big hug and says, okay, well, I'll see you back in L.A., man. In 5 weeks, we're going to start rehearsing. And I went, what? And he goes, yeah, welcome aboard. Stick with Abe and Rusty to show you the ropes. And that was it. So I go back home, like set up a guitar, a bass, an acoustic, a mic, big old stack of CDs. Remember those CDs? And I'm rolling through everything he's ever recorded, Beatles, solo, Wings, and everything. And I get a call one day. He goes, and I pick up, he's going, hello? He goes, hi, Brian, it's Paul. And I go, Paul who? And he goes, you know, Paul, the bass player. And I go, Paul who? He goes, Paul McCartney. And I go, no, it isn't. He goes, Brian, it's Paul McCartney. And I go, no way. And he laughed so hard that he had to hold the phone far away. And just like Michael, for you, he said it happens all the time to him.
Yeah.
So I think they just like to fuck with us.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah, for sure. No, when you asked me about the first time I met Ringo, I had really wanted the gig.
Yeah.
And I told Keltner, and like Greg Bissonette is the guy, goes, you're perfect for this band. And he brought Dave Hart, who's Ringo's agent and producer of the shows, to see us play. Toto was playing, and they were on the road in Europe, and we were playing at the arena there, and he brought Dave Hart to see me play, and Dave really dug it, and he chooses, so he put me up for the gig, and the idea is Ringo has to approve everybody, so like he listened to the music and said either yes or no, and I called Keltner, and I said, Jim, call him and tell him I really want this gig.
Hook me up.
Hook me, get, you know, put in a, high, a good word for me, because I just wanted to do a season and say that I did it, you know what
yeah.
I mean? And it worked out great, you know. And then, you know, so I got the gig, but I couldn't tell anybody about it. And I think at that time we had just had lunch.
Yeah.
You called me and said, let's hang out. And we met somewhere. And I said, I play with Ringo. And you looked at me like, and Will Lee looked at me the same way when I said, what is with the look? He goes, well, man, you know, he's great. He's had some interesting bands that didn't gel really well, you know. And I said, well, I'm going to make that difference. And Keltner was like going, you can go in and make this better. And I go, if I don't, then I suck. And not to say that there weren't great bands, because there were, but there weren't bands that were cohesive on a friend level, like on a
right
hang level, which right. as we both know is pretty important when you got to spend all that time on the yeah. boat with people.
Ringo just wants a laugh.
Yeah,
he just wants to hang.
I mean, he doesn't need the money.
He wants to do the work, but he wants to have a good time, man, because he doesn't need to do it.
No, the thing is with Ringo is he's a band guy.
Yeah.
He wants to play. He takes the music really seriously, and right. I love him for that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's all about that to him, you know, and you take, you know, like rehearsals are important. I'm going to myself, I'm going, do we really need a rehearsal? He likes to feel better about really having it together.
So what was your first meeting with him like?
Well, I came off the, I'd just gotten to Canada and it was a late flight. So I got in late and it was about, I don't know, 9:30 at night. And I got off the floor and he was waiting for me. And he opened up the door and he came out and he gave me a big hug. He says, welcome aboard. And he goes, now get some rest. We're starting early. I said, yes, sir. But he gave me a really warm hug. And I said, I'm going to fucking make this. I'm going to give this everything I got. I quit smoking, drinking, and doing any fucking illegal shit, you know, over 10 years ago.
You know, you and I come from a time in the 70s and 80s when we were coming up in the business.
We all sleep when I'm dead years.
Yeah. When it's what you do.
God, I wish I could get that back, man. How stupid was that?
Yeah.
God, I don't miss any of that shit. But, you know, I woke up one day and I said, this is it. And I quit smoking and drinking and everything the same day. Never looked back.
As funny as stopping smoking is what led me to stop drinking and using, too. Yeah. Oh, that's
well,
great.
They all go together.
Yeah, they do.
You take
yeah.
one out of the equation, it's all wrong.
Yeah, it's like a two-legged stool.
It's like doing a bump with one side and not getting the other.
That's right, yeah. Well, I'm glad that you ended up changing
no,
that.
No, I mean,
pathway.
I had to. Listen, I'm really ashamed. I mean, I went through a period of time where I almost destroyed my career.
Really?
Because I would suck. Mm-hmm. I was so miserable doing what I was doing, and I didn't care. And what an awful thing to all of a sudden not care.
Mm, interesting.
You know, and,
yeah.
and people were beating up on me, and they should have.
Yeah.
I was squandering a great career, and I was blowing it. I was ashamed of myself, and I spent 10 years trying to get that back and apologizing and admitting it in public that it got the best of me and it ruined my playing.
Well, what changed? What did you wake up one day and just say, that's fucking it?
Well, I mean, the depression was hitting, and I realized I had hit a wall. I felt like shit all the time. I started day drinking. I started doing all the shit you weren't supposed to do.
Yeah,
I couldn't even look at myself in the mirror when I was brushing my teeth. It was that bad.
Wow.
I was puffy and red. I looked like shit. I was ashamed of myself. But I kept, you know, you just keep going so you don't feel it. And then when you finally feel it, it's brutal, you know.
Mm.
So I had a couple of days of sweats and depression. And then, you know, I went through a lot of shit, you know. But, you know, I never went back to, you know, wanting to have a drink. I mean, I lost my taste for it.
Yeah.
And I just don't want any part of that life anymore, you know. I mean, not to the point where I was a blithering idiot, you know what I mean? Occasionally something comes up and the comment section are like, it's brutal.
Yeah.
Boy, if you ever had an ego, you can get rid of that real quick.
Oh, yeah. Just stay away from the comment section,
I mean,
man.
Yeah,
that
I mean, imagine
so
you guys
rough.
Get beat up, too, just
oh,
because
yeah.
you're not John Lennon or something
yeah, you
like
know
that.
What? You know what? Absolutely. And you don't get through this life and this career of all these years that you and I have done this without some embarrassing moments on YouTube. So it's just like I stay the hell away from the comment sections.
But no, yeah. I think it's just toxic.
Let's talk about the earlier years of your session work and
sure.
and songwriting collaborations. Run us through a couple of guitar solos that you would deem your favorites that people
oh,
may
know
not know out there that you're responsible for some of the most killer guitar solos in pop and rhythm and blues history. Come on, brother. Come
You're
on, we're talking
man.
About Running with the Night by Lionel Richie.
Well,
come on,
fun.
Let's hear
that
the story.
That was a run-through.
Was it?
I wasn't even trying.
What?
I was going, what key is this in? I had my Les Paul out, and I'm 59. Plugged in, and cranked it. He goes, well, obviously this was the time right after Beat It, so it's like, oh, rock solos and R&B are going to be cool.
Yeah.
So I've been working with Richie, and I love Richie. He's great. He goes, I got this song Running with the Night, and I want you to play all over it. And I go, okay, well, what key is it? Let me figure it out. So I just play all over it. Mm-hmm. Just, I'm warming up, doing my thing. I'm picking the spots that are rather obvious, and I'm playing. I'm going, and they're digging it. And at the end of it, I go, great, let's make one. Let's do it. I think I got a handle.
Let's cut it.
He goes, you just did.
What?
I go, what do you mean? I don't even know the song. He goes, it's great. You're done. I was out. That's the thing. And to me, I played too much on the record, and they used it all, but... that was a long time ago. That was like 1982. So I cracked up on that. Was like a negative session. I didn't even get one take. I didn't even know we were keeping it.
Wow.
And I used to be pretty good at getting it quick because you didn't have a lot of tracks.
Yeah.
Some things got by that were a little like, ooh, that was a little under. That was a little dodgy. Ugh, wish I could do that again. But
hey, man,
but
those
at the
were
same
the
time, that was the shit was happening, man.
The part of the style of the times, man. Are you kidding me?
Man, I got in there and did what I had to do because I had to. That was the gig. Were you going to be 10 guitar players? That was what I found the best challenge.
Yeah.
Because I get to be everybody's guitar player. So I was really careful about getting the right sound, playing the right parts.
Yeah, right.
How can you not play this iconic part of a Santana solo? How can you not play this George Harrison solo with the right sound and use a Leslie on this? And I tried to give it my all to everybody. Yeah. Todd needs this. I'm going to play this. Or whoever needs what, I'm into it. You know, I mean, that's part of my fun. As a session guy, that was just normal behavior for me.
Yeah.
So, and you know that, you get in there and you do the job. And of course you learn the parts on the record. Are you going to come up with a better bass part than Paul McCartney?
Yeah, I mean, exactly, like, right?
Am I going to come up with a better solo than the one that's on, you know, George Harrison played on? It don't come easy. Yeah, it's simple, but it's classic.
Yeah, it's classic. I want to talk about Africa a little bit.
Oh, boy.
When it came time for, where were you when you heard the Weezer version of it so recently? Was that something that was just like out of the blue? Or
no,
they sent us
Rosanna first,
which
was pretty interesting.
Okay.
And, you know, I don't understand why they were doing it. You know, I think, as I come to find out, there was a girl, a sweet girl, like 15-year-old girl, from back east who, you know, she was heard our song on Stranger Things. Believe it or not. And for a year, it was bugging Rivers Cuomo to fucking cut the track, because apparently they do old songs from the 70s and 80s and shit like that.
They do some covers? But yours was the first, I think.
Yeah, well, they did Rosanna. We got that, and we were like, okay, well, nice try there, guys. And then they did Africa, and really, they tried to do pretty much the same arrangement, but they just put the crunchy guitars in the solo, and Rivers did all the harmonies and stuff like that. I thought, hey, man, why not?
Yeah.
The groove was a little funny to me because of the way we made the record. It was Jeff and Lenny and all the loops and stuff. You know, it was a whole different thing. These guys were more approaching it like a rock band would.
Yeah.
And, you know, hey, they did a good job. It was a hit.
Well, let's hit you with a couple of quick ones. This is a section of the show we want to call the encore.
Right.
We know that the non-glamorous side of what we do is the travel. What's the craziest travel story that's happened to you?
I think getting to South Africa from L.A. was pretty rough. That was a 30-hour, you know, door-to-door. I think I donated my underwear to science at that point, man.
Oh, my God. You did not.
No, I'm just kidding.
Okay.
You know, that was rough. It's just the waiting around, man. It's the canceled flights. It's the getting in after an all-nighter. You know, even when we're fortunate enough to do, like, what we get to do with the guys, which is travel really well.
Right.
It's still, you know, you get there at 3 a.m, you get there, it's interrupted sleep. It's, you know, even the best to travel, it's, you know, we've been doing this my whole life. You've been doing it your whole
Same.
Life, man.
Yeah. Well, tell me this. What's the most embarrassing thing that happened to you on stage and how did you get through it?
Food poisoning.
Oh, my God. Me too. Yeah. So you went and did the show anyway?
Yeah, I had to.
Oh, my God.
I was on one of those, like, jazz fusion gigs. We were doing 14 in a row. Couldn't afford to blow one out.
Lord almighty.
You know, so you have to work a lot to make the money. And I was on stage and, like, you know.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I could have fucking crushed a walnut between my butt cheeks, man, you know. I could have turned a piece of coal into a diamond. You know, and, you know, I had to, like, yell drum solo at a very inopportune moment and run down the stairs. There's nothing like that feeling of sitting on the commode having fucking Mount Vesuvius coming out of your anus while the band is still playing. And you're going like, okay, man, you know. And then you realize that, like, it's really bad. And, like, you know, and you got to fucking get through this again. You get up there and everybody applauds. And you get through it. You got that weird sweat. You know what I mean? It's like you're going, every song is like 30 minutes long. And you're like, God, how am I going to get out of this? You know?
Oh, man.
And, you know, so that's a bad one. Embarrassing things on stage, just forgetting shit and just being an idiot. But
hey, we all do that. Okay, is there anyone that you've played with or met backstage that you've been completely starstruck by?
Well, you know, same people by you. Over the years, when I first met them, it's people like Jeff Beck and obviously Paul, George, and Ringo, you know?
Yeah.
When I first met George, that was a trip. I was at a nightclub, believe it or not, right after Jeff died.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going to do a gig at the amphitheater as a tribute to him. And, you know, George came and played with us. I met him that night and we hit it off. I just want to say thank you for my entire career. And he said, sit down for a second. I started making him laugh. And the next thing I knew, we were really good friends until he got stabbed.
Yeah.
And then he lost touch with everybody.
Yeah.
And then I would get a message through Keltner, somebody saying, George said hi. He would call me. I wish I had kept some of the great outgoing. Hey, it's your new good buddy, George. Fancy a meal. You know, I remember driving him, me and Keltner, I was working on my second solo record back in 93. And he goes, come on, let's go have dinner. Keltner's coming. And Jim knew I was working. Let's stop by the studio and dig what you're doing. We were working on it. Mm. So I drove him into Capitol right after the Blue and the Red album,
mm-hmm.
Best of Beatles or whatever they call mm-hmm. it.
Yeah.
Volume 1 and 2, the Blue yeah. one. And the Well, they had the mega life size, like as high as Capitol building, the size of four Beatles backstage. And I drive into the lot and he goes, bloody hell. And he's like, it's massive.
It's
and
the 50-foot Beatles.
And I walk into Capitol, you know, the security with George Harrison, and they're looking at me and looking at him. I go, I bet you don't need to see his ID, do you? And they just let us in, and they hung out for a while. But we hung out a bunch. I heard Free as a Bird before everybody. He took me up to his place. He was staying at the Bel Air Hotel
right?
with Olivia, who's awesome. And he played that for me, and you know he came and jammed with us, and he just became a great pal. And then he disappeared, and I never got to say goodbye.
Oh, that's so sad. Well, so tell me a last question. What are you listening to right now that you're excited about?
My son's record.
Yeah.
I'm not just saying this because he's my kid. He's in a band, Mike Picaro's someplace bass, the drummer uh-huh. from One Direction, who's a killer drummer, and they found this singer that's just insane, Josh. And they just made a record that's just ridiculous.
Really?
It may save rock and roll. It's like, if you can imagine a young Def Leppard.
Is that right?
With the song quality of Hooks. And my son plays guitar, not a wheelie guy
yeah.
at all. He yeah. was never that. I said, I'll get a bolt cutter if I see it with that fucking.
Yeah.
I go, that's so over. They go, be a songwriter. Find parts. Have a great feel.
Right.
And he went for that. And he wrote some great shit. And now he's sitting there waiting for it to come out and going like, oh, my God.
What's the band name?
ZFG, Zero Fucks Given.
I like it. Yeah.
And,
ZFG.
You know, it's a big deal. It's coming out, man. I'm really proud of them. It's not just good. It's like, holy fuck, this is great. Fuck you. This is too good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he's cracking up. But he's been his 20-year overnight success. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, he's been working really hard. I wish I could tell you I helped him.
Mm.
I helped him with a few things, introducing him to the right people, but everything he did on his own, you know?
Amazing. Yeah, he's a good kid.
He's a great kid. He skipped over all the awful shit that I did.
Is that right?
He actually listened to me.
Well, thank you so much, man, for sitting down with me. This is a blast.
I'd like to thank everyone for listening, and thank you to Steve for having us over to his beautiful home and spending so much time sharing his incredible stories. Be sure to watch for Steve's new music on his website, stevelukather.com. On Tour is a production of iHeartRadio and Black Barrel Media. This show is produced by Mandy Wimmer with executive producer Noel Brown, and I'm your host, Brian Ray. For more information about On Tour, visit our website, blackbarrelmedia.com. For behind-the-scenes photos from these interviews and interact with us, visit our social media at On Tour Pod on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. For more shows from iHeartRadio and Black Barrel Media, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.